Hello, you're listening to a spoiler-filled film conversation. Hooray!
Barfly is the film this week, and I am Richard. Hello, with me are all my friends. Oh, except
Except
one
Jamie.
actually. Jamie's here.
Yeah.
He should be, but he got blown away in a tornado or something.
No
So,
shots for Jamie.
yeah. keep a shot under the bar till next week. Anyway, also here is Anthony.
Hello, friend.
Cheers. Friend. And Abby. So, this week it was Abby's choice of film, and she picked Barfly, as I said already. So she will give you the deets in case you get it confused with other films.
We watched Barfly from 1987, based on the life of successful poet Charles Bukowski and his exploits in Hollywood during the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Directed by Barbet Schroeder, written by Charles Bukowski, starred Mickey Rourke, Faye Dunaway, and Alice Krieg.
Is that how you pronounce it? Krieg?
I don't know!
Sounds better than Krige or cringe, I suppose.
I'm going with it because I fucking nailed it.
I like it.
So, why did you pick the film, Abby?
Just lately, I've been getting into the work of Charles Bukowski. Then I found out that Mickey Rourke was in a film that he wrote based on his stuff, and I was excited, so I watched it, and then I shared it because I liked it.
The film Charles Bukowski wrote, Mickey Rourke starred in. It did sound a little like you were saying Mickey Rourke wrote it, but just for clarity, it was Charles C. Bukowski's wrote this film.
He actually went by
Chuck.
Frank or Henry.
All
Charles
right.
is his middle name, and it sounded better as an author's name to
Oh,
say
because
Charles.
the character in this is called Henry, is that right?
Yes.
And this is semi-autobiographical on Charles Bukowski's behalf.
Yeah, it's based on the stuff I've read. A lot of the stuff happened over a much longer period of time in different places, and then he's just sort of tied them together for the purposes of a film.
Into a kind of drunken romance. So, how did you get into Bukowski? What kind of writer is he?
He's a grubby little man.
Makes sense.
He's someone you shouldn't like. This is one of the reasons that I put forward the film, actually, is that you should not like this man, but you like this man, and it's troubling. Everything about him is a twat, but you love him.
So he's a slightly, because he's kind of a pretentious, well, not pretentious. He's a kind of he writes about the scrubby, dirty part of working America and bars and love and sex and all kinds of stuff like that. Just but he's got a way with the words, and he's a good novelist and author, is he?
He's got his writing style is phenomenal, but he just writes about things that are so grim, like not even like sad, grim, just as like
Like
ugh.
people having sex in an ashtray, kind of. I don't know, I don't know. They're not shrunken down or anything. I just wanted to reach for an analogy. But yeah, it's kind of people who meet under a beer mat or something. Yeah. So you've been getting into Charlie Charles, and you wanted to see if me and Anthony were like, "Yes, he is horrible, but I do like him," or if we're like, "No, it's repugnant. This is disgusting. Yucca V," which is gross for people who don't speak a bit of Welsh badly. Yucca V, that means horrible. Learning and gurning. So, Anthony, what did you know, if anything, about this film when Abby suggested it?
When we chose the film, I didn't know anything about it. I didn't really know what to expect. A possible just a kind of drunken comedy, perhaps, with some grim moments, perhaps. But then, like a couple of days before watching this, I think Abby then mentioned it was kind of based on Charles Bukowski's work, which I didn't know at the beginning. I've never read anything, but I know of the guy and his kind of general style, so that kind of keyed me in a bit more to what to expect, a little more grimness perhaps. comedy, but no, I really didn't know what to expect. This was a really wild card for me. I could have gone anywhere. I think I was going to like it, but that's kind of the only thing I had going, if you know what I mean. The only other thing I'd say is maybe because it was a film about drunk people, I thought maybe it might have got annoying at some point.
Sure, so...
That's all I was coming from.
Okay. Well, my perspective is similar. I knew that Abby had started reading Charles Bukowski's books at quite the pace. She'd be getting through them and really enjoying them and finding some kind of writer kingship with him, even though she's not a lusk. That's not the right word, is it?
A lush.
A lush. I knew I was saying it wrong. You're not a lush, Abby. You're not one for waking up under a car or whatever. That's someone who's had a horrible accident, I guess. No, anyway, point is, Abby was into it. I'd read a few of the poems he'd written, which are quite good sometimes, but a little bit, oh, bloody hell, poetry's weird. So I'm not a big poetry fan, but it was all right. Kind of interesting stuff about love and other things. But yeah, and I know, Mickey Rourke-wise, that interests me. Like, a young Mickey Rourke is very different to, contemporary Mickey Rourke.
Yes.
He's all fucking weird looking, but good now. And back then he was kind of handsome and a bit more like the Fonz or something. And this one's interesting because he's young, but he's playing kind of dirty and rotten looking. So it kind of works. But yeah, I don't know, really. I was looking forward to it, but I wasn't sure. I knew only vaguely how the tone would be. Obviously, drunks and bars were going to be a thing. Yeah, so a bit like you, Anthony. Yeah. I mean, this is an interesting film because there's not that much of a driving force of narrative. It's kind of bookended by two bar fights. But fundamentally, it's just the goings-on of an unemployed drunk man and his drunk girlfriend.
His various stumblings through life, yeah.
Literally, in some cases.
Right. This is the first thing to tackle, then. His walk and his demeanour. He kind of slouches around the place, Mickey Rourke, in his saggy grey trousers. And he's very stained as an individual. His T-shirt's a bit worn, and his clothes are a bit grubby. But he sort of slouches about and grimaces, but in a nice way. Can he grimace in a nice way? It's got a peculiar paunch.
It's like he only just woke up permanently.
He
does look kind of terribly pained every time he wants to move.
He's got a cigarette hanging out of his mouth most of the time. He's usually got either plasters or blood on him somewhere. And it's got, Rourke's lank, kind of just classic combed back, slightly grubby hair, bit of stubble, and he affects a slightly odd voice. How would you describe it, Abby?
Well, allegedly he was trying to do Bukowski's voice, but I don't know how accurate it is because I've heard him speak, but it was in a an interview, and that's a much different way of speaking.
Is Charles Bukowski also Snagglepuss from Hanna-Barbera? Because that is how he sounded. He sounded like Snagglepuss if Snagglepuss was an alcoholic.
I think Mickey Rourke has fallen exactly in the middle between them. He's closer to Snagglepuss than Bukowski was, but Bukowski wasn't at a great distance.
Oh, heavens to Murgatroyd. Pour us another shot, even. It's like, just like very odd. It's just... I liked his voice. It was much more calm and like he was a bit more like a surfer than an aggressive bar jerk. And I think that worked in the favour of believing that this scab of a man could get anywhere with a lady, even if it's a lady who is herself a bit of a bar junkie.
It was a slightly weird one for me because his dialogue and the way he speaks is very unnatural, or at least it seems unnatural. Mm. But then, because it's so unnatural, it's, you know, it seems believable because, yeah, this is just another human being. Except, yeah. So it's a weird one. It's a kind of it's a balance of feeling natural and feeling over the top, if you know what I mean.
I do know what you mean. I agree, there's something odd about how he talks, and I think it's Charles Bukowski, having read some of his poems and not his actual like novels and biography type things. His poetry is it has that kind of, you know, it's almost like beat poetry rhythm to it sometimes. Mm. It's a bit different. And because the character of Henry is a writer, and he's not your usual bar drunk in that he's a bit more thoughtful and a bit different, and I don't know, he kind of has an odd humour to him. Maybe that makes him seem, at first, unusual. But like you say, it's odd because unusual leads to realistic, in a way. Like, it's... You wouldn't do a piece about someone who's boring. And I think there's an authenticity somehow. And I think it's because he's like Charles. He talks like Charles Bukowski would have, presumably. Or at least writes himself to sound. Maybe he writes himself to sound a bit more weird and cool. But I don't know, I've not met the man.
Yeah.
You've read more of the books, Abby. Can you weigh in on the Charles Bukowski language problem?
Well, I know that Bukowski wasn't nuts about Rourke's performance at first, and then it grew on him, and how he said that Rourke stuck to the script word for word, exactly, but then he added his own flavour in the actual way of speaking.
That kind of noise.
Bukowski does have an interesting, I'm going to say syntax, hoping it's the right word. But that's one of the things that drew me to him, is that he wrote presumably how he spoke, which is the same thing that I do, where you don't necessarily obey the rules that you normally would.
Or a common structure of a sentence.
So when you're reading it, you can tell his sort of rhythm of speech. And I'd say that this is, it's fairly close, but obviously it's being delivered by another person. So it gives it that different spin to it slightly.
Yeah. Well, I liked it mostly. I think I liked listening to him. I liked the way he talked. I didn't like it when he was actually, like, Henry would start to do poetry. Like, he would think of something or say something vaguely eloquent, and he would either write it down or, you know, hash it out. And
but
I found
had
that
to,
kind
though?
Of pretentious. Mm. It just felt, it clanged with the tone of the film, I felt.
Yeah, but you can't do a film about a writer and not see them write occasionally.
Yeah, it's totally justified in that it's about a drunk who writes stuff and gets famous a little. Yeah, the part of the film is this Henry guy who's a barfly, or, you know, person who is always going to bar. I don't know, do we need to explain to people what barflies? Just someone who is always at the bar drinking. And in Henry's case, he's, you know, almost permanently broke. But he's happy about it. He's happily low on income, just scraping enough to get a few drinks and start fights and stuff. So, you know, he's a happy-go-lucky alcoholic.
It's because it's elective.
Well, I mean, it's partly elective. He's got to be addicted, otherwise, you know.
Well, the drinking is elective, but the choosing the way he spends his money is... Bukowski did... He worked for the post office for 12 years when he was in a stable relationship and they needed money. I think he'd had a kid by then as well. But before that, he was just, I'm not going to do a job I don't like. I'm going to live on whatever money that I can make doing stuff I can dad. And that element of his life is completely elective. He could have had work. He was intelligent. I think he started to go to college, but he didn't finish, which means he definitely finished high school.
I don't know, it sounds like someone painting a problem as a choice, but I wouldn't judge. I kind of liked some of the philosophies on how Henry talks a little bit to the bar staff and people about just riffing off of the idea of your people define you as what you do and how that's kind of wrong. How I like the notion that you're not whatever you decide to do, and you're, why do we always have to, oh, you are a barber, you are a mechanic, I'm happy now because you're defined in a role. And really, it's awkward when you don't have a job because no one can put you in a box and know what you are. And I find that irritating when I was unemployed. Just people, they need you to be wrapped up and understood. And so I like that bit, his philosophy on that. It was kind of interesting. But you're saying, you know, anyway, the point was, he is a poet and is successful and is getting attention, like, with a magazine. Is that where the first, like, bit of... Because, like, there's a character interested in producing his work. Is that right? A posh lady?
Yeah, I think that might be... I'm trying to remember if the name of the press was accurate.
Because there was magazine. One that...
Oh, yeah, I think it was Sparrow in real life who actually gave him the time of day. But they might have called it something else in this. But yeah, the woman and the private detective with her are pursuing him because they want to use his work, but they want to deal with him directly because he doesn't have an agent or anything like that.
Because he's a rubby. Yeah, and so he's obviously talented, and that's how he's going to slowly, you know, maybe get some money other than just doing a regular job. So it's weird because he gets luck, but he doesn't care about it that much. He's like, the whole thing is him delaying the fact that someone wants to give him money, and he's almost not. He slams phones down. He doesn't want to deal with these people. He's not interested in getting paid or getting notoriety. He's all only concerned with, I don't know, booze and women, I suppose. Did you find yourself liking Henry, Anthony?
I did. I've been trying to put my finger on it, and I guess it's, he does some questionable things, he certainly. Does. But I think it's because he kind of is true to himself, if you know what I mean. Like, he's got his own philosophies and his own kind of code of living, and even though it's a bit grubby and a bit crap at times, he sticks to it. And he's quite committed to the lifestyle, and that's kind of endearing in its own way.
Yeah, he lets people know how he feels. He's honest, and he lets people know, I am about drink, and, you know, I guess the good times of that brings, and that's all. And I don't care about being, I don't need to be rich, I just, you know, he barely needs anything to live. He's got some baggy trousers and a couple of dirty shirts, and possibly a radio, actually... Something that made me a bit weirded out. It felt, Anthony, like an origin story for John Radio, a semi-local celebrity who goes around with a radio and a bent fag in his gob all day long. And the fact that he owned a radio...
True story, I almost walked into him today.
Did you? And yes. How did you avoid colliding?
I just managed to step out of the way in time.
It's good to know John Radio's still out there, wandering around, a la Mickey Rourke in this film.
But yeah, weird tangent to say.
Yeah, completely too niche a reference, really. But he's honest. He's an honest guy. He's not pretending to be anything else, and that's admirable in a sense.
I think that's why I clicked with him so much when I was reading his books. I was just like, you are so painfully honest. There are people who would take some of this stuff to their grave rather than admit they ever did it. But no, you're just putting it out there as something that you did.
In a way, Henry Bukowski, whatever, is a struggling artist, but he's almost choosing to struggle. You know? I'd rather be in my pit with my problems than be out of it. And what's the... He's obsessed with... The character of Henry's obsessed with people being unoriginal. He wants to be different and alternative to everyone else, and he doesn't like obvious people, he says, doesn't he?
Yes.
Obviousness.
Well.
He does sound retarded, doesn't he? But yeah, essentially, the start of the film is just he's in one of the many bars. There's some groovy music leading us in, showing us some bars, you know, light up bar, like dive bars across America or on location in
LA. All in Los Angeles, yeah.
Yeah. And so we go in and meet, we kind of see the dynamic he has within the bar, and he's a sort of friendly drunk. apart from he has a nemesis, which is one of the barmen, who looks a little bit like a low-quality Rick Rude from WWE's 80s period. That's just...
Frank Stallone?
Is it?
Yes, it is.
He's moustache and mullet and bad attitude.
Mickey Rourke, like, really pushed for him to at least get a...
He wanted to punch him in the face?
Audition.
He was a friend who he really wanted to pretend fight.
Mm. Well, it's a good choice. I mean, he kind of looked... He really looked and sold the part that he was playing, I think. He really looked that kind of 80s macho, cool but not cool
insecure,
kind of thing.
Insecure, machismo, douched asshat.
Yeah.
Just looking for a fight with someone who's fairly affable, if slightly irksome. That's how I would describe Henry's characters. Yeah, he might be a bit annoying, but not enough to go and have a fight outside. They actually take it outside, like, the proper way. The way that people say they're going to do. Oh, do you want to take it outside? And no one ever does take it outside. They just don't fight or do fight. But they, in this, they obey the rule of go outside the bar to have fisticuffs in the alley. Which is admirable, in a sense. Unusual.
I like the weird sense of community that was there when they were having like the fights.
Yes, that oh yeah, let's all go out. It's the thing. It's the entertainment for the evening. We're a bit sick of the jukebox, so yeah, let's just watch a fight, take a few bets, and then you know back in for more drinking.
Was he hustling, Eddie?
I don't think so. I don't think it was a deliberate hustle, because he didn't even... Like, one guy does some betting in one of the later fights that they have, like one of Henry's friends, and Henry doesn't even want the money. He's like, oh, this is your cut, and he's like, he's just reluctant to take it, so he's persuaded to take the money he makes from winning the fight and everyone betting on him, against him.
The way that I saw it is, you know... Like in a boxing match, they always say, you know, it's not about giving a beating, it's about taking a beating. And I think, like, he's clearly by this point mastered the art of taking a beating. So I think that's like, I think they have a second fight towards the middle, and he manages to get the drop on him. And I think it's just because he's, you know, he's by this point, he's been used to being smashed up.
And he's drunk enough not to feel it as much.
Yeah.
So maybe.
Okay.
Not a deliberate hustle, necessarily.
Mm. So kind of like a metaphor about being, you know, poor and drunk and having to deal with a lot of hardship in your life, and how that's actually can be a kind of a good thing, because it kind of makes you more stoic and
sturdy.
And sturdier.
Well, this is the thing, is Henry's life seems to revolve around bars of a day and an evening, and then he can't help himself but provoke this guy, and he has a fight with him, and, you know, this is the format for his life. And I think, what's the cause he has, like, so when they go back in after one of the fights, he can't get served anymore in that bar, so he's sent packing, and he has to find a different bar. And this sets up his romantic interest for the film. Is that right?
Yeah. Because Eddie owns the bar. He has refused him service, so none of the other guys can serve him because he'll get fired. So then he goes elsewhere. He got what he came for.
Well, I think what's good is Eddie, who loses one of the fights, is sort of sprawled over some bar stools with some woman tending to him. And he's just like, no! He can barely tell him not to serve. He's like, oh, just serve him. Like, I'm still half knocked out. I think that was nice. And Henry just sort of has to shrug and leave. It's so affable. He just carries on with his life. Abby, do you want to talk a little bit about Faye Dunaway?
Her character's name is Wanda in the film, and she's in the next bar in Henry's Odyssey.
Crawl.
The same bar, one of the patrons is Pekoski himself.
Really?
Yeah, he's He sort of gets a close-up, but he's looking the other way, so you can't tell.
Just a slightly pock-faced older man.
Yeah. And that's where they meet, and one of the first things she says was, I hate people, do you hate people? That's pretty much what this is about.
he doesn't quite say he hates them, he says something akin to...
I don't hate them, but I feel better when they're not around.
Yeah, that's how I feel. Yeah. A bit of a loner. No, I get that sentiment sometimes. Just feel that way. Yeah, so they mutually are antisocial and drinkers. And he buys her a drink and then confesses that he is broke, unemployed, and poor. And, well, the two of those things are the same. But he essentially admits to just being a useless, worthless drunk. And she's cool with that, because she is as well, I guess. Although she keeps herself a little better. She's not as much covered in blood. She moisturises in the film properly, not with blood.
That's because she's got a sort of sugar daddy.
She has to keep... Well, she also probably has a bit more dignity. But she wears quite nice dresses and suits for a lush.
Yeah, I thought... Plus, being a woman as well, there are, different pressures. Like a man... Like, Mickey Rourke kind of gets away with looking rough all the time, but kind of like it's harder for a woman to do that, if you know what I mean.
The scabbier ladies who also hang out in the bars Mickey Rourke goes to are those kind of, okay, you're definitely living alone. Well, you're not so much living alone because you're never in the house, you're always at this bar stool. They're not as well kept together. But they're probably a bit older. She's a well groomed alcoholic, who's a little rough around the edges, but is getting by.
She seems a bit more functioning alcoholic than maybe Rourke is.
Yes, she's less of a seat of your pants alcoholic, more of a I've got plans, like you say, Abby. Sugar daddies seem to be the way she keeps herself propped up on the bar stool.
So one guy in particular, he acts in, based on the books and the film Factotum, he keeps a sort of harem of women.
Who does?
And this sugar daddy guy, and I'm trying to remember his fucking name! The guy that they call...
Yeah, from the... They go to a liquor store.
Walter? Was it Walter or Randall?
Wilbur. Yeah, but he keeps women in the sense that they go around freely, but he gives them a place to stay and food, so they stay around then. But he won't directly give them money.
He sort of keeps their tabs open if they...
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's a scene where the shop owner or clerk or whatever has to phone up Wilbur to check that she can buy these beverages because she basically instantly teams up with Rourke. He's considering how much of a lowlife he looks and behaves sometimes. He does very well. He's like, in a sense, it's sort of, oh yeah, this bloke writer is writing a character that's basically him getting instantly laid despite being probably smelling like a dog has shit into a shoe. There's no way he's meant to. He's going to smell of bar and BO, probably worse.
Yeah, but and they both smoke and drink, so they don't have any nostrils left.
And those two smells masquerade any other problems, really.
Sure.
But yeah, he instantly, sorts... Well, they hook up and they head to a clerk, to a liquor store, and the clerk phones up Wilbur and OKs the purchase of several drinks. And I think there's a promise that she'll come by later on that she, doesn't follow up on. So she's sort of semi-exploiting this man. But she, she feels some guilt about it. It's not like she's utterly okay with it.
I was going to say, I just thought in general she was a very interesting character. And also, like, her portrayal was again, it's kind of like all about kind of balance in this film of characters, and for her, it's the kind of balance between you know, this woman is an alcoholic and should be kind of flat on her face all the time. But then on the other hand, yes, she looks a little bit rough, but then she's also still incredibly, you know, a very attractive woman. And I think there's like one scene where she's got like her legs on display and they look fantastic. And at the time, like watching the film, it definitely, you know, it definitely fitted in with the flow of the film, that kind of scene. But I recently, like looking back on it, I thought it kind of stood out because this film is not sexy at all.
Not really.
And it's kind of one of those moments. It's probably the only moment of kind of overt sexiness is when she's got like her legs on display and they're talking about them.
Yeah.
And I read in the trivia after watching the film that that was not originally in the script. And it was kind of an extra glamour shot for Faye Dunaway because, you know, she's an incredibly striking woman. And
you know, I think that's good, though, because it's easy to forget people who don't carry themselves with a sort of va-va-voom kind of sex appeal. That, you know, normal women going about life are still appealing to most heterosexual men are, you know, interested in even, you know, people who are a bit hungover or drab. It still works. You've still got something going on, whoever you are. You know, so I think it's an important factor to show, like, oh, well, you know, she's got some assets as well as being nice.
Yeah, but it's the kind of balance, like I'm saying, with like all of the characters. I don't know, like, I can see why they like wouldn't have put that in the original script, if you know what I mean. Because, you know, the whole thing is so kind of grubby and dirty and, like, no one kind of looks nice at any point apart from her. So I was thinking back on the scene and it kind of stood out for me as just being more sexual than the rest. But it did work. Like, I didn't think about it at the time of watching it. It felt fairly natural, like, the way you would speak with someone, you know, that just met and getting into bed with.
Of course. If anything, there probably should have been a scene where Mickey Rourke gets to look appealing, because he does not. if he doesn't look like Trevor from GTA 5, he is just... There's nothing... Like, I can't think of a scene where you go, oh, well, he's a bit of alright. You know, there's no moment where he like pulls a t-shirt off, even if he'd pulled it off badly and tripped, but was still kind of in shape. No, it's just he's like a lovable dirty dog who you found in a skip. There is
one moment, and it's when he's wiping his face at that hydrant, and it's the only time you see him like clean, proper clean.
And
like,
again, a dirty dog licking up a hydrant. So, and Mickey Rourke, very attractive chap, especially back then before the odd body alterations he went through. Even after them, he's all right. I don't know. That's the only thing you could question, is the credibility of lust. But then they're both cut from the same cloth, so it's about a personality match, really. Mm. It's this message of there's someone for everyone, I guess. And it's the love between two barflies, and that's a grubby love, but an authentic, believable one nevertheless.
I kind of found this film a little more romantic than actual romance films, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's more...
Because it just rang true and, more relatable.
That was one of the things I really liked about it, where there's no real moment of schmaltz anywhere. It's just two people who like each other and enjoy each other's company.
Yeah, and understand each other.
Yeah.
So when they do something kind of wrong, yes, they kind of get angry about it, but they also understand why.
It's like they both understand the other one's broken. And it's like, well, of course you did that. You're broken.
And they're very forthright. Like, she comes out with the fact that if there's a guy who comes with like a quart of liquor, I'm probably going to go with him. She's like, we are lovers now. And he doesn't even realise he's kind of drunk to the point of not remembering their first hookup, where he kind of snuck into bed with her and she accepted him in there, and so they establish we're in a relationship, but we're all about the liquor, so that's what decides our lives. And that's frank and forthright, so it's kind of they're both like that, I suppose.
Yeah. And again, it's just because that's what relationships are. Like, they just kind of happen rather than, you know, you meet someone and then let's go on a date and it's no kissing till the third date kind of thing. It's like, that's not how it happens. Just how they just kind of stumble into things and just go with the flow and just all makes it so you kind of, you know, this is real life, or at least, you know, a better approximation than other kind of romantic movies are.
Yeah, because a traditional romantic comedy has a formula and the act structure that's very conventional and a clear arc that you know you're going on, and they often behave with, like, their friends are slightly more polished comedy characters, and they have the nasty characters that are going to get in the way. And it's much more like a rom-com doesn't actually get what romance is about so often, whereas off the beaten track films like this get it, because it feels more relatable for the obvious reasons that we've pointed out so far.
Well, yeah, there's a few moments, like, not the most grubby ones, I hasten to add, but there are a few moments where if you change booze to DVDs, it would just be us.
Okay.
Like, rom-com, like a typical rom-com is more interested in the idea and the philosophy of, like, love and romance, whereas as philosophical as this film gets, it's more about the realities of love and romance.
Yeah, I mean, they fall in love in a sense over stealing some corn and hiding from the police. Well, unripe corn as well.
Was that just corn growing in the wild?
In LA, in the suburbs, and then there's just a massive crop of corn, like you
Not
do.
Not massive. Someone's small. Got a small holding, I think.
Palm trees, I understand.
Okay.
They used to, like, have palm trees in my old street, and I didn't live in the Bermuda or whatever. But just a cornfield.
Like an allotment.
Yeah. And it's the kind of corn that you're not allowed to just take freely, like, you know, blackberries that grow in the wild and you just pick them off the sort of side of the road. The cops come after you if you steal unripe corn. And then, they have to tiptoe. They hide, they get away from the police and they hide in this woman's apartment and kind of quietly wait out the cops leaving. And Mickey Rock, you know, Mickey Rock says it's unripe and they shouldn't take it, and then he's proven right when they cook it, and she's really upset with how, like, she kind of is upset with how sad and annoying life can be because her corn is undercooked, underripened. She has a right strop. But that's how love stories should start, shouldn't they? You know.
Yes, I suppose.
Best in disappointment. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good start. I like the fact that they steal corn. So honest. Get your corn out of my face. She's so upset about it. I love it.
There's another moment later on where he's drunk and upset because she slept with someone else, and he throws all her clothes out the window.
Yeah.
But later on, he has to collect them all and bring them back in again. The way that he does that is so cute.
Old Rick Rude, it is, because they split up. I think Mickey Rourke tries to get a job, or Henry or whatever, and he goes for an interview and he's got that crappy, like, he filled it out and it's just like, hobbies none, religion none, sex none, and it's like, you know, you could put down mail if you like. They have that back and forth bit of comedy about how getting jobs is so stupid and crap. And then because of that, they've split up for the time. Not, you know, they didn't break up, they just are apart. And she, off screen, has hooked up with old Rick Rude from the bar, Eddie, because he had some liquor on him. And so she's gone to bed with him for a bit, and he's upset. And as you say, throws the clothes out. But then later, when he's a bit, I don't know if he's sobered up exactly, but she calls at some point and, you know, wants to hang out. And he's like,
he's got all his blood black back in his body.
Oh yeah, we have to talk about that in a sec. But essentially, he's just, I would like to hang out, and he goes and fetches all of her clothes off the lawn, which have been there overnight, presumably, and stuffs them all by. I love the scene where he's on the couch and she comes in, and she's like, "Where are my panties? And where's this? And where are all my things?" And he's just sitting there like, oh, I don't know. I was looking for a lottery ticket. You don't do the lottery. Oh, how about that?
just before that, though, when he'd put all the clothes away, and then he very casually lies down on the sofa like it never happened.
Yeah.
That was perfect the way he did that.
Another thing about the character of Henry is whenever he gathers things up, he always overloads himself. And he has something in his teeth, whether it's like a piece of toast or a hanger. He has to be utterly, like, every limb and his mouth have to be full of things, and he has to awkwardly, drunkenly move around with them. I like that. But yes, there was an accident of sorts. Oh yeah, she hits him with a bag, and that's how he gets the back of his head open, cut open. Is that right?
Yeah, he's just being catty about her going off with Eddie, and then she's had enough and just starts beating him with
a lead-filled handbag, presumably.
It seemed like a bit of a flimsy handbag, so I don't know how it did that much damage to him.
I think it was in the book. It was either like a big bottle of perfume or maybe like a cold cream or something. But she had one of her nice-smelling things in there, which was in a particularly hefty receptacle.
So he gets his head bashed in, and then he goes around for the rest of...
Just covered in blood.
Like he's Andrew WK. He's just like, whatever. I'm just going to have blood pouring from my head on my T-shirt. I'm going to go to bed and drink some more and just put up with it. And then is it the PI turns up and tries to get hold of him again? And he slams the door in his face. And like, I guess the PI calls the ambulance men, who reoccur as a kind of reoccurring joke throughout the film.
Was it him? I kind of figured it would have been Wanda, half scared, half remorseful, maybe phoning up while
it's
she's
been
gone.
Been a while, though.
True.
Anyway,
doesn't really matter.
Can someone describe these ambulance men? Because they're rather special.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, it's part of one of the things I liked in this film is just the small background characters that clearly, like, Bukowski has kind of met over decades of living and just kind of, like, slotted them in here and there. And these guys are, like, I suppose one of them. They're kind of put upon like LA paramedics who have clearly been doing the job for a long time and are used to being called out to nothing.
I like their grubbiness as well. Like, you got one of them has slightly thicker mullet-ish hair and it is a bit cheeky, and one's slightly more portly and older, and together they are worn out and their uniforms are barely on, you know. They just want people to sign forms and piss off, because if they don't have an emergency, fuck hanging around. So they do feel put upon and experienced. And it's a good scene because they think there's a corpse they have to pick up, and it's actually just because Mickey Rourke has a wound and he's covered in blood, and they have a comedy interaction where he just, because he's drunk and awkward, he's not signing the thing and explaining himself properly.
And possibly concussed.
Yeah, in
some sense.
I like they don't force they don't sort him out. They just want him to sign. You're not a corpse, then we can leave you with a wound bleeding. That's fine.
They told him to get some rest. That was true. The ambulance guys, I think, based on my very shallow knowledge of medicine, I'm pretty sure they give the wrong advice every time. If you hit your head and you've got a concussion, you're not supposed to go to sleep, and they tell him to go back to bed, he'll feel better.
That's good. Bit of social commentary. What's the second time they turn up? It's because Wanda and Henry have made up and have got back together properly for a bit, and she's drunk and they start drinking together, and she goes to bed.
Near-death experience.
In bed. She thinks she's going to die. But she's just drunk. But he still calls for an ambulance because he's a good guy. And they turn up and inform her that she's drunk. And the cheeky younger guy basically says, like, well, she's a bit fat as well. And it's just like, there's no need for that. She isn't fat to start with. But
no, on the slightest.
That's what I mean about the wrong advice. It was like, you're saying that woman, she's too fat. Are you fucking high?
Yeah. And by this point, they're even more... they're worn even more thin? Is that the phrase? They're annoyed. and sure. starting to be a bit agitated by this constant calling wolf or whatever.
So when there is someone legitimately dying later on, it's they might not come.
Well, that's it. The third time is an actual accident. Henry has a fight with an angry neighbour who's been verbally abusing his wife. Another bit, because this is the thing. The film, on the surface, like almost first time round, it feels like it's not a comedy. It's almost a subtle comedy because it's about the mannerisms, the expressions, the facial reactions. Like, there's lots of very good written jokes that, like, the idea of having an abusive neighbour who, when you actually break in to try and stop him murdering his wife, she's into it and they're faking it. It's just a part of a kink they've got. So there's proper sick, and then the recurrence of the ambulance men, like off screen this time, they're called back to deal with a man who, like, they have a fight because, you know, that's what Henry does all day, is fight. But he has a scuffle with his neighbour and he gets accidentally stabbed, and the ambulance men have to come back off screen to sort that out. We hear about it secondhand, don't we?
That's the hook. Yeah, it's weird as well, like. The old guy has a good speech about how, like, I don't like you. That's just the way it goes sometimes. It's sort of like, you're being so reasonable and also a dick.
And again, for me and you, Abby, relatable is just those fucking neighbours where you're like, oh my God. You just sit there, like in the case of Henry and Wanda, you sit in the bathroom. She's in the bath, he's on the floor, and they're just discussing what the neighbours are arguing about and just musing over the caterwauling through the walls.
For us, it was a man upstairs who sounded like he was moving coffins all day.
I mean, what was he dragging around? If not coffins of the many people he murdered. I don't know what he got up to, but he liked dragging things about. It's very irritating. Anyway, more niche references to our lives. Yeah. Someone get us back on point.
Yeah, I want to get back to just a little mention of some of the smaller kind of background characters in the film that I remember. Like, obviously, these two, the neighbours, were kind of them. It was a kind of funny joke when you burst in and they're both into it kind of thing. There was a guy who comes into the bar at one point and can't.
Is this the shaky guy?
Yeah, the shaky guy, just a guy who wants his drink but can't. But, you know, we'll find a way to do it.
He puts, like, a makeshift sling on so he can kind of pull the drink to his face.
Yeah. Why they couldn't have given him a bigger glass, I don't know.
Or just someone else, I don't know, a straw.
Yeah. And the one that I really liked, a very in-passing one, they're just walking down the road, Wanda and Henry, and I think Wanda needs a light, and they just ask a random guy on the street, and he's just really happy to give them a light. Like, this is his only interaction in decades with someone.
This is raison d'etre. I think the idea is he's this poor, pathetic old man who has nothing in the world, but for once he does have a lighter. He can be of use to someone if it's just lighting a cigarette. And that is enough for him. That's made his day. And that's a really funny and great scene. I agree with you.
Oh, there's a good line that comes with that as well. Is something like, she says something like, see, angels are everywhere. And then Henry says something like, really? Well, they better come out of fucking hiding.
There's a lot of mentioning of angels, isn't there? There seems to be a theme of people are being, like, it becomes like a pet name after a while, and an insinuation about people. Even when they do the lightest bit of help, they are angels to these drunken idiots. It is peppered with these interesting characters. I do like that about the film. It's easy to ignore them.
And again, just adds to the whole realness and relatability about it. Because, you know, as a person kind of going through life, a lot of your interactions are just kind of fleeting.
Yeah.
And this, you know, like you say, it's peppered all the way through. And it just adds a nice element. And I remember some of those moments. Going back of just like the little characters in the background doing things, and
the drunk lady, the woman who's old, like a very weathered face but like quite big hooters, and she's always talking about sucking people off for money. Like, she's just an old prostitute. Well, Abby, what's the thing about paste she says?
Oh, nobody sucks paste. No, nobody swallows paste like me.
How could he be proud of something so disgustingly put? Says I.
And it's just, yeah, geez. Coming from you. Yeah, that's I how I don't low say and unwholesome.
Paste. Oh my god! But she's always trying to cop off with some old man or pathetic drunk throughout the film, and I like the casting is great. The look of all of the alcoholics, the locals and the regulars, and just the down and outs and the sad and the pathetic, and how they have a kind of happy camaraderie amongst each other. They're all sad, pathetic, and a bit worn and poor, but you know, other than being slightly begrudging or a little bit down, everyone's all right with it. It's really a poster for alcoholism, this film. It's a big propaganda piece for why alcoholism isn't that bad for you, really.
It definitely has that touch of romantic, like poor romanticism to it.
Yeah.
Where even watching the film and them acting like they do, being grubby and just generally being kind of assholes all the way through, and still you kind of want to be there doing it too.
Yeah.
One thing that could go very wrong is people who romanticise the poor and being broke are usually middle-class wankers who don't know what they're talking about. It's that it's like the Common People song. It's just people who see, oh, I love the working class and the poor. It just is so cool. And people make films about it. Like, Shane Meadows does it really well because he understands it. And I think Bukowski has written a script that works in favour of it. But it's very dangerous to romanticise alcoholism, poverty, you know, essentially two people who cheat on each other. You can be a prick about it and not get it. And if you don't get it, it's awful. And it can be very grating and irritating to see people go, oh, isn't it great? Because it's, you know, it's not great being poor a lot of the time. Being broke and getting by is just fucking knackering sometimes. So you mustn't make it out to be better than it is, but it doesn't make it out better. It just says people sometimes are like this and they're fine with it, I guess.
Yeah, and what you're saying is kind of symbolized by the publisher lady who comes along and has read his work and has obviously read into it. I think she says at some point your stories were so romantic, I was hoping you know, it came from you. And she's obviously that kind of middle to upper class person who's romanticizing his world and kind of wants to inject herself into it.
Hmm. I think that is a significant factor in the film. Henry is eventually pinned down in one bar or another by this woman, and she calls the house and he hangs up. What's the scene where she finally gets to find him and take him out to get some money?
It's the one Wanda's just gone off to try and find a job, and he's come back to the apartment and she's just waiting for him there, and it subsequently ends with the stabbing of the next door neighbor.
She explains herself, and as you say, she has this romantic notion of what it is to be an alcoholic poor person writing these presumably poetic articles for the magazine, and she's in love with him and wants to essentially spoil what's so special about him by making him rich and famous, and he doesn't want to go along with it really, but he's up for some money for you know, his stuff. And they have a kind of outing together, don't they?
And she kind of doesn't see that, if you know what I mean. She constantly says, why don't you stop drinking, Why don't you write in my nice study where it's all quiet and stuff?
It's not punk rock, mate. It's not punk rock.
it's that kind of thing of suffering for your art. You know, you need to go through some kind of bad stuff to make beautiful things. You know what I'm saying?
You don't want to lose the authenticity by rubbing out what made it authentic in the first place, yeah. And you know, maybe Abby, how do you feel? You're an occasional writer. How do you have to be in the right situation to write, or do you not to relate to this element?
I find a weird thing where he never had this, or at least he never covered it in his book. but some stuff I can ignore. But TVs seem to hit a frequency that just needle me. They really fuck me off. TVs. But I think, like, if you're really flowing and you're in the zone, you can ignore almost anything. And sometimes when it is just you, and, well, in my case, a laptop, but he had a typewriter for a while and then he went on to paper and a pen. If it's just you and it, it's just too much. It's like a spotlight on you and you can't do anything.
Yeah, you can't have pure calm. Yeah, you can't have tranquility. You need a bit of something to sit amongst, or maybe.
Mm. Plus, the way we've seen him write in the actual
film,
I couldn't find the word there. film, the thing we discuss every week.
It's only the third word of our podcast title.
Yeah, he writes when he has inspiration.
Bleeding on the way to the bathroom, kind of. Drunkenly musing over your girlfriend in bed or something.
Yeah, so like he writes a page and then just kind of tosses it and draw for maybe to look at sometime in the future kind of thing. And I also relate to that.
Yeah, creativity strikes when it wants to. You can't be in a sterile environment necessarily.
Mm.
And it just, that lifestyle isn't for him. He doesn't want to live in a posh house and he knows what his life is. It's get enough money to drink and rinse and repeat. And so what does he need these extra problems of large houses and hobnobbing with the rich people of LA? So, forever. But he gets her drunk a bit and they sleep together, almost, not reluctantly, but he just going with the flow as he always does. He sleeps with her and then leaves. And he takes his 500 and takes it back to his less fortunate girlfriend. And I think, doesn't he kind of climbs up on the bed like a kind of gargoyle, or like he crouches down like a monkey and rubs all the money onto the bed and just says, "Look what I found." And she's like, who have you murdered? What? Why did you have this money? I didn't get a job. What is this? I don't sure if he does. He does eventually explain himself, doesn't he? But
yeah.
It's not about that. Money.
And then they piss it all away.
Yeah, instantly.
Yeah, it's time to go back to the bar and buy drinks from my friends. From my friends / people who are just here today.
The fucking freeloaders that came in halfway.
Yeah. Yeah, what's interesting is he not only, someone who's an alcoholic might keep all that money to keep themselves in booze, but he's very generous. He doesn't mind over tipping, and like even the barman who he hates, he gives tips to and says keep the change, almost to wind him up. I like that Rick Rude is holding all of the different drinks ever, and he has to pour. He's annoyed that he's getting loads of this guy's money and that he has to pour drinks, which is his one job. Like, he's still bothered by this guy. It doesn't even make it. It's not like, oh, this guy's got money. He's just, I don't like you. You're here again. You better pay up your $42 for this round of drinks, you know?
I want to talk about the bookending bartender before I forget.
Yeah.
And how we come, right at the beginning of the film, we come in through the front door of the bar. And this other barman is working the bar and he's by himself because everyone's out the back and he's fighting.
Yeah.
And every time they have a fight, he stays in and he minds the bar. Mm. And he's there when we leave as well, just sitting there reading the paper while everyone's outside and they're having a fight. And we back out of the door like we came in, and then we look up at the top. And I just love that he has never seen any of these fights, but he knows exactly what's happening.
He knows. It's also, this whole film is this man's break in work to just do a crossword. It's just every significant thing that this film's about, he just sits and ignores. Because someone has to stay inside, and okay, who needs to see Mickey Rourke be busted open again? So yeah, it is sweet. It's a good way to bookend it because it started the bar with a fight, and this guy with his just ignoring it, and end with it. And we also we all switcheroo. The ladies have to fight, of course, because a man who is a scab with alcohol poured on it has two women fighting over him again. you know, slightly vanity writing here, I think. I mean, I'm sure this kind of thing has happened, but, oh, a man has written himself to have two women who only want to get with him.
He wrote a poem about it actually happening to him and how he was looking in his bathroom mirror. He couldn't believe that it was, there were two women literally fighting over him. I think he was like 40 or 50 by then, and he was just so fucking chuffed to bits about the whole thing.
It would be. But they have a good fight too. Proper they bar fights, like, you know, cat fight, borderline dog fights.
Yeah, it's fight down, it's got form. Fuck.
Yeah, it was almost more brutal than the actual men fighting all the way throughout.
Well, the man fights are a bit more stagey. Like, they're punches and falling down and bashing bottles. Or, like, there's a good bit where...
Yeah, it's...
Go on.
I was just going to say, it's more like legit boxing.
Yeah, like a back alley brawl. Like, you know, bare knuckle style. But this, when old Eddie Rick Rude gets fucked off, he jumps the bar to have this fight. Like, they decide we're going to have a fight. He jumps the bar in frustration. And then Henry jumps over to the bar and starts drinking alcohol from behind the bar at the same time, just to add insult and more liquor to injury. And just, I love the way he smashes up the bar as they go as well. Like, he breaks things on the way to the fight outside at one point as well. But I like that the way it's a perfect romance is you've got these two characters, both alcoholic barflies, both, you know, live similar lives. One keeps themselves in slightly better state than the other. But fundamentally, they're the same all the time. They both cheat on each other for reasons. They come back together all the time. And then she kind of, the fight is kind of stopped between the two ladies, and I guess Henry and Wanda make out a bit and drink some more. And, you know, they're right for each other. This is what the film shows us, is they're kin. Everything about one character is applicable to the other character. So that it's, you know, perfect bedfellows, perfect mates. And that's what's nice. That's what gives you the satisfying, yay, the couple we love has stayed together feel that all rom-coms want you to feel. This does it, and it does it in a spectacularly foul way.
Yeah, especially as an audience member watching the relationship unfold, I think you're in the back of your mind, you're always thinking like, oh God, this is just going to go really wrong. They're going to be terrible influences on each other, and, you know, both of them together are probably going to end up killing themselves.
You do expect it to end in a horrible kitchen sink drama where one of them has killed the other one, or just they'll ruin everything. That's the type of thing we're set up for. As literate film people, we expect it to be a moral story about how alcohol ruins your life. And in a way, it refreshingly doesn't.
Hmm.
Sorry, I wasn't meaning to step all over your point, Anthony.
No, it's fine. That's my point.
You enjoyed the fact that it did this?
Yeah, and, you know, it's slow and believable, and you understand their motivations and where they're coming from, and you can see, like, little by little, they are kind of good for each other.
And they're very tender and friendly. Like, they're always nice to each other, despite arguing like any couple would. And they're very, you know, they ignore the flaws, which are numerous.
Mm. And coming back to the kind of bookend point of the film, it kind of ties into this, where at the beginning you're introduced to the people just having a fight, and just off of that you come thinking, oh, this is really grim and horrible, and, you know, no one wants to be going through this. But then come to the end, when they're going out for the fight at the end, you see that it's just normal and everything is okay. So being with the characters for the hour and a half has made you kind of understand everything. So by the end, it's almost, you're almost want to see the fight, rather than thinking, like, this is horrible, they're fighting in the back alley, which you did at the beginning.
You understand that this is all just part of the game. This is how their life works, and it's not to be, you know, it's not tense, problematic thing. It's just how the game is played. This is what we do. This is what we've chosen our lives to be. So get on board with it, or, you know, go to a different bar.
Yeah, they very much, they bring you around to, they don't change the way that you feel about it, but you are now sympathetic to the way that they see it.
Yes.
And I really like that. It's a really rounded set of characters by then. So you just, you get it, you click.
Yeah. I mean, I think on paper, although on paper you do like Charles Bukowski, the ideas of this film are unappealing and you would find irritating. But yeah. I think through a heady mix of acting, dialogue, location, and directing, like, it works. It brings it together and makes you like it. And you sympathise with these characters when really you shouldn't. You know, to describe some of the elements of this is horrible. And you can't understand how it could work as a romance film. And yet it does. I think it's relatable enough. There's so many different moments that if you smear off some of the filth, ash and booze, there is a legitimate, relatable love there that they've captured. And I think, you know, fair play. It's good to do that and have a bar where they have a framed picture of a truck with Christmas lights around the rim that trail off to the plug. And I mean, decor like that. Wow. That is not the setting for romance, and yet, perfect. The perfect one for this particular one.
There's, other than a few just little bits and bobs moments, I think I've pretty much covered it, and it's just stuff like Anthony was saying earlier, it's just all the little human things they do. Like when she comes back from her night with Eddie, she tidies herself up, she comes into the room, she goes, "Hello."
Yeah, she gets herself ready and prepared to greet him. And, like, the fact that the ambulance paramedic guy has slagged her for being a bit fat or too fat or whatever, and he just says, "You're not, you're perfect." And it's just like, oh. It's that, like, very typical, like, romance thing to say, like, just to just to make someone feel more secure about themselves. So it's sweet as well as disgusting. So I just want him to change his bloody shirt when he has it on.
I would like to assure people that there are poems and anecdotes relating to Charles Bukowski washing.
Wash. I remember he seems to enjoy having a wash with his lady friends. I remember reading a poem about that, and the soaping of balls was mentioned. So
plenty, I mean, yeah.
That's good. Good to know that we don't have to worry about the hygiene of Charles Bukowski quite.
I just wanted to make one more point because it's the last note that I've written down. And there wasn't any music in the film.
At the start, like,
other than that, and maybe at the end as well. But all the music was diegetic, pretty much.
That was in the scene.
Henry just kind of putting on the music.
Yeah.
And just that adds to the relatability and believability of everything that's happening. Because again, as human beings like we are, that's generally how we experience music. We put it on the radio and it's the score. It doesn't have a score there to kind of pepper your emotions, don't tell you how to feel.
That's a fair point.
I read something that there was no score. Some music was chosen by the department for the film, and then Mickey Rourke picked some of the classical music himself, but he didn't say which ones. But I think they were all good picks, so whichever ones he picked, good for him.
Well, yeah, it suited the feel and tone, and Anthony was saying it makes it real and creates a tone that suits the type of film it's being. So it's when done right, it's effective, but it would have felt a bit cheap to have the swelling of orchestras at the right moment and things, and the anticipation building in certain scenes would be awkward. Just let the actors do it.
Yeah, I think so.
So well done, Abby. You've picked a film we've all found agreeable.
Yes, in fact, I've only seen it quite recently, so I need to give it some time to settle in my mind, but I think this might go to my top 10 favourite films. I really enjoyed this one.
Oh, wow.
The first time I watched it, I only rated it 3, but then the second time I watched it, I rated it a 4-star. So it grows on you.
I found myself thinking about it after I watched it as well, which is a sign of
definitely.
Well, I think it's definitely in the category of different romance films. Like Submarine is another film I thought of that's a romance, but not like a conventional one. That one being about kind of teenage love and alternative kids who, you know, fucking around in the Swansea area. It's got an authenticity and a relatability that comes from not being cliched and obvious. Like the film very much doesn't want to be obvious. Henry doesn't like obviousness, and the film isn't that, but yet it perfectly captures the idea of what romance is about, which is two people meeting each other and getting on like a house on fire. On possibly that fire was started with lots of liquor poured everywhere. But,
did they have the fire department scene in this, or is that in fact Tottenham?
Fire department? I don't remember that.
Okay,
ambulances. Yeah. Well, the sort of companion piece to this is Factotum with Matt Dillon, where he plays a Charles Bukowski type character.
Yeah, that's more specifically based on the book Bukowski of the same name, and it covers some of the same ground as this. So it's interesting to see how it's done differently by different directors and by different actors. Like, and I know the book as well, so to know how it relates to the book is fascinating. I recommend it.
I don't know if any of you guys have watched the TV series, but this film reminded me a lot of Shameless, the British TV series Shameless. Yeah. And I think after watching this, I'm now regarding Shameless as a kind of the British Bukowski.
Sure.
So,
the thing,
is that anything
the thing,
someone wants to be? I don't know.
Another thing it put me in mind of was Louis C.K. did an internet TV series called Horace and Pete, which stars him and Alan Alda as Horace and Pete, who run a bar. Oh, and Steve Buscemi, who's the other Pete, I think. And they run a dive bar in New York that serves like one kind of beer and has loads of alcoholic regulars, and it's just about the grimmer side of life, and it's a very dark comedy about bars, and that it feels like this fits in that world as well. So that, and that's a good recommendation. Louis C.K.'s Horace and Pete series is on the internet, and you can find it, and that's a cracker. Good stuff. So yeah, you know, we should move on to the old metaphor part.
It's almost required to take a turn for the gross.
I'm going to say it's like eating fancy liqueurs out of someone else's ashtray. They're boozy, they're sweet, they're dirty, and you don't care because you're a bit drunk anyway, and you're going to nom them all up and you're going to just spit out the ash. How's that?
I'm trying to think of something related to, like, drinking. Something like, it's like a warm, authentic glass of Guinness, and you look at it, and you smell it, and you touch it, and you go, no, I don't want to drink a warm glass of ale, and it's going to be horrible. But then you drink it, and it's the most wonderful experience. Like, it's not your typical kind of sweet, nice alcohol. It's earthy and it fills you up in a different kind of way.
Yeah. And it's got that bit, Guinness has got that slightly wrong feeling to it. It's just not quite like all the other ones. But yeah, it's that beverage that you don't fancy, but you can force yourself to get into it. It's really good.
Yes. Well, I wouldn't say force yourself. It's just once you've tasted it, you realise that actually I was wrong all along. Like, this is lovely.
Yeah, you weren't up for it, I guess, rather than you don't go, oh, God. You know, it's like just not sure about it. Yeah, okay. Abbe? Which fly is it? It is the bottle. Oh.
It is a dirty little dog.
dirty little and dog.
When you see it at first, you're like, oh, you're dirty, I don't like you. And then it follows you around a bit. And when you look back, it gives you this little look with little brown eyes. And you're like, okay, you're a little bit cute, but I'm still not picking you up. And then you keep going, it follows you around a bit more. And then, like, it does something, maybe it picks something up for you or something like that. And it just wins you over slowly until you're like, fine, I'll give you a bath. But you're not mine. Yeah. And you keep it.
And you know, it's always at its best when it's not had a bath and it's been out playing and digging up bones and bring filth into the house. And you think, I'm going to wash it again, but it won't be until it's playing that it'll be happy.
It'll immediately go out and rub itself in whichever smelly bit it's found.
And then drag its arse all across the carpet and leave a nice mark. But that's what dogs are, so you love it anyway.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Okay, so it's oddly warm Guinness, not specifically warm Guinness, a mangy dog, and filthy sugar habits being nommed up from an ashtray.
I just like to point out, I didn't do a food metaphor.
I did. Hooray.
You guys.
So let's tip some liquor on the ground for our fallen podcaster, who hopefully will rise again and join us next time. He's not dead, as far as I know.
Maybe it up.
Yeah, no. Anyway, let's raise a shot glass to all our friends!
All our friends!
And to you, listener, yay! Right, that's your lot.
Till next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Good stuff.
Eddie!
Good grief. I'll pour you now. Love that line. I'll pour you. He never did pour him.